With Tom on point and weapons up, they moved cautiously toward the first of the shacks. When they looked up the narrow lane that led deeper into the ville, they could see bodies on the ground, left where they fell.
Biblical.
Mildred and Tom followed the moans to a doorless one-room shack on the right, with delaminating plywood walls and a sheet metal roof. Mildred entered first with her ZKR 551 in a two-handed grip. The skipper backed her up with his 45 caliber Smith. There were no windows in the hut. The only light and air came from the doorway and the cracks in the wall seams. The heat and the stench, the coppery smell of blood mixed with fleshy decay and expelled bodily fluids in the enclosed space, was paralyzing. The concentrated stink burned Mildred's eyes and the lining of her nose and throat. The woman was in her late 20s, in a gauzy, badly stained Hawaiian print dress. She lay on her back on a pallet on the floor. Her dirty blonde hair was matted to her skull with sweat and oil. Mildred knelt beside her, taking in the deathly pale cheeks and chin crusted with dried gore and vomit. She was bleeding from her nose, and blood oozed from the corners of her mouth. Her eyes were wide open, and she didn't seem to be aware of Mildred's presence. Ryan watched from the door, his weapon ready. Tom leaned over Mildred's shoulder, his gun lowered to his side.
Oh, shit.
Stay back.
Glancing around the hut, Mildred counted four supine bodies on the floor, one adult and three children. Only the young woman was still alive. From the distension of their bellies and the ghastly swelling of their limbs, the others were long gone. Was the woman the children's mother? Had she looked on helplessly as all her babies died? Mildred's mind automatically made those tragic connections, although there was no way to tell if they were accurate.
I can't examine her in here. It's too dark, and the smell's too awful.
Is it safe to move her?
Safe for her or safe for us?
Both.
I doubt it's going to matter as far as she's concerned. It's safe for us if we don't get her blood and other fluids on bare, broken skin. Be very careful picking her up.
Using her clothing, the hem of her skirt and the back of her dress collar, Ryan and Tom hoisted the sick woman up like a sack of grain and lugged her limp form toward the doorway. As soon as they stepped into the wedge of hot sunlight, the woman reacted.
Shit. Hang on, but be careful.
Maintaining control with difficulty, Ryan and Tom rushed her into the lane. As they did, blood trailed out from under her skirt in a thick crimson ribbon. They set her down on the hard-packed sand and stepped well back. She lay there, eyes open, hands trembling. The brief violent struggle seemed to have taken everything out of her. Doc looked at her pale, tortured face, smeared with gore and vomit.
Dear sweet Lord.
Holstering her weapon, Mildred knelt again. She noted the petechia on the woman's exposed upper chest and throat, and the facial pallor and cyanosis, blueness around the mouth. She gently touched the woman's extremities and found them cool and clammy. With difficulty, she found a pulse at the wrist. It was rapid and thready. Mildred summarized the symptoms in her head. Agitation followed by prostration and collapse. Evidence of high fever, vomiting, and diarrhea. Facial pallor and cyanosis of the lips. Profuse sweating. Bleeding from mouth, nose, and gastrointestinal tract. Her pulse dangerously weak.
Based on the symptoms she's presenting, I think it could be some variety of hemorrhagic fever, yellow or dengue. There's no evidence of redness of the tongue or jaundice to the skin, so that eliminates yellow fever. As I recall, there were four serotypes of the dengue virus, none of which was fatal. But any of the four varieties can escalate into dengue hemorrhagic fever or dengue shock syndrome, which are both very bad news. Without oral and intravenous fluid replacement and supplemental oxygen, the pre-dark mortality rate for DHF and DSS was close to 50%.
You sound somewhat less than confident, my dear. Is there a remaining question regarding the diagnosis?
Afraid so. A real big question. Back in the day, only 1 out of 100 infected with the virus advanced to the hemorrhagic form of the disease. Based on the body count I'm seeing, it looks like everybody here caught it and most of them have died.
Can you help her?
There's nothing I can do. Not even with a plasma drip if I had one. Her platelet count is probably so low at this point she'd bleed out at the intravenous site. She's in the final stages of circulatory collapse. That is, her heart isn't pumping hard enough to move the blood through her body. She's dying.
Can we catch whatever she's got?
Dengue is a blood-borne virus. Infection requires blood-to-blood transmission. Mosquitoes are the primary vectors of dengue fever, and that's how it's spread from person to person. Look around this place. There's puddles of standing water everywhere. We need to be long gone from here before the skeeters come out.
Can you hear that? Can you hear that?
The skipper didn't wait for the others this time. This time he forged ahead, full speed up the path. As Harmonica Tom disappeared around the winding turn, JB scowled.
He knows we can't sail a rad-blasted ship without him.
Then we'd better hurry up and get this over with. Let's go.
Mildred didn't immediately follow her friends deeper into the build. She remained by the stricken woman's side. She couldn't do anything to help the poor woman, but she was unable to walk away and desert her in her final moments. She had lost everything, everything except her pain. Mildred reached down and put a hand to the clammy forehead. There was no way of telling whether the woman could hear her, but hearing was one of the last senses to fail. The doctor leaned closer and gently, slowly, stroked the crown of the woman's head.
It's okay for you to give in to it now, honey. It's okay. It's over. It's okay to stop fighting. It's time for you to let go. To float away and be with your darling babies again. It's okay. It's okay.
As Mildred stroked and reassured, the woman's body relaxed, head to foot. Then the trembling of her hands stopped, as did the shallow, frantic rise and fall of her chest. And she was gone. Gone like a shot, to wherever she was bound. Mildred carefully brushed close the lids of her blankly staring eyes. Mildred had seen hundreds of people on the verge of death since her reanimation. Despite her extensive medical training, she'd been able to help few, if any, of them. But that experience had not inured her to the death or suffering of others. Death and suffering had always touched her heart before, and she was touched now. The first time Mildred had died, she'd skated on the experience. She'd been unconscious and on an operating table. When the next time came, she knew there would be no anesthesia, no oblivion. There probably would be intense pain, and she hoped that someone, even a complete stranger, would be kind enough to tell her goodbye. She scooped up a handful of sand, and as she hurried to join the others, used it to clean her fingers. After wiping off her hand on the leg of her BDU pants, she unholstered her check wheel gun. Around the bend, she could see more dead people. They were collapsed across the thresholds of the wall-to-wall huts and face down in the lane, which was no more than 15 feet wide. The others had fanned out to either side of the path and were leapfrogging, checking bodies and looking into the shacks. Suddenly, JB looked back at the others.
Hold it! Everybody freeze! Don't take another step!
Everyone stopped and looked at JB for an explanation. Standing in the middle of the lane, he reached out with the barrel of his scattergun and pointed to a thin black metal wire running just along the surface of the sand. It was stretched perpendicularly across the path between a pair of ramshackle structures.
Tripwire. This place is mine.
From 20 feet up the slope, Jack waved a bone-white hand and pointed at the ground.
More wire, over here.
And here too.
Ryan stared at the ground in front of him. Mildred watched him as he looked from tripwire to tripwire, following them to their respective endpoints.
It's a rad-blasted triangle. Three anti-personnel mines. From the looks of it, they've been rigged in unison. One blows, they all blow. Anything inside the kill zone is guaranteed chilled.
Mildred looked up the lane, past Jack and Ryan, beyond the tripwires they had located. The noise seemed to be coming from one of the shacks on the left, a hut higher on the hill that they hadn't searched yet.
We need to back out of here right now. Back out the way we came, very carefully, in the same footsteps if we can.
Before they could retreat even 3 yards, a disheveled man crawled out of a hut on the left. His face was crusted with dried gore, and fresh blood oozed in a wet red stripe from his nose down over his lips and chin. He was heaving himself forward into the lane, crawling in their direction.
Wait! Help me!
Stay where you are! Don't come any closer!
But the man kept coming. Mildred's heart sank as she watched Jack raise his Colt Python and take careful aim at the poor, delirious bastard who was about to kill them all. But before Jack could fire, Tom's stainless steel Smith & Wesson flashed. The .45 caliber slug kicked the man's head hard to the right. His brains exited in a puff of pink mist mixed with bone fragments. He dropped to the sand, with his twitching hand 6 inches from the tripwire. Mildred saw a wave of dismay and disgust cross the skipper's face as he looked down at the cratered mess he had made of the man's skull.
Stupid, stupid, stupid!
Before they could resume their retreat down the path, 2 very sick men staggered into view. Raving with fever, coughing, bloody, but still on their feet, they lurched downhill.
Stop where you are!
Perhaps they couldn't hear him. Perhaps they were hallucinating and didn't understand the words. Perhaps they didn't want to understand.
Back up! Everybody back the fuck up!
Seeing the companions in full retreat made the sick man come even faster, wobbling down the lane, straight for the wire. Tom bolted to the right.
Hit the deck!
The companions split up, diving for cover on either side of the path. Mildred and Christy barreled through a doorway shoulder to shoulder. They hit the crude floorboards hard on palms and knees, almost skidding into a pair of bloated human forms. The ground shook beneath them. Ball bearings blasted through and splintered the plywood wall like a volley of grapeshot, whining over their heads before slamming through the far side of the shack. Dust and rust rained down from the underside of the corrugated steel roof, down on the open eyes of the hut's former occupants. As Mildred and Christy backed out of the wretched hovel, a dense smoke cloud hung over the lane. As it lifted, all that was left of the 2 sick men were their legs from the shins down and bloody rags flung against the scorched and partially collapsed fronts of the huts closest to the combined blast. JB shook his head in disgust.
Claymore's in tight quarters. Nuking awful.
Ryan turned to Tom as he rejoined the group.
Have you seen enough? It's too risky to go farther. The Ville's a lost cause. Last time I anchored here, there were a lot more people than what we've seen. The others must have taken shelter up in the ship.
Could they all be dead, Mildred?
Christy, from the way this dengue variant seems to operate, dead or dying are both distinct possibilities.
After they had backtracked to the edge of the shantytown, Christy frowned, glancing back.
I don't understand the connection between the sickness and the laying of the claymores. The islanders wouldn't rig their Ville with booby traps unless they thought they were about to be overrun, and unless they were leaving it to the invaders.
The unfinished grave and the discarded shovels imply a hastily diverted purpose, as do the strewed corpses, the abandoned dying. I'm afraid there is only one logical order of events here. The plague came first, the booby trapping second. No one in full command of their faculties would tripwire a Ville that was still inhabited. I think we can assume that circumstances beyond the islanders' control forced them to stop dealing with the outbreak of disease and its aftermath, tending to the stricken and burying their dead, in order to lay explosive traps for their enemies and then withdraw to the relative safety of the grounded vessel.
But that would mean...
We're in deep shit.
As if in confirmation of that fact, in the distance out to sea, huge engines bellowed to life.
Come on.
Ryan waved the others after him as he turned away from the Ville and stormed toward the slope opposite, beelining for the top of the island's sandy spine, an elevation that would give an unobstructed view of the southwest and the source of all the racket. Cresting the top of the dunes, the companions had their answer. 7 vessels approached the southwestern tip of Padre Island. The fleet was about 2 miles offshore and closing. 4 large sailing ships, 3 massive tugboats with black smoke pouring up from their diesel stacks. The sailboats had all their canvas unfurled and were beating against the wind in a staggered formation, moving to the left for the gulf side of the island, while the tugs bore straight in for the point, 3 abreast.
Do you recognize the ships, Tom? Do you know what's going on?
Not a clue. Especially about those diesel-powered boats. How the hell did they get enough fuel to run them? How did they get so close to the island without starting them up? They don't have masts for sails.
What?
Without warning, in a blur of pale hair and limbs, Jack jumped backward a good 3 feet, bumping into Doc before he could shuffle out of the way. Inexplicably, Jack aimed his .357 Magnum Colt Python at the empty ground directly in front of him.
For nuke's sake, Jack, what is it?
Something under the sand. Not right. Something moved.
Everyone pulled their guns, aiming for the same place. His pistol in front of him, Jack edged forward. He carefully dropped to one knee and brushed the surface of the sand with his palm, revealing the top of a fractured-off piece of plywood. Around the ragged edges, the grains of sand funneled away, as though through an hourglass, into a big hole beneath. Ryan signaled Jack to stand and take a step back.
Whoever you are under the board, you've got 7 blasters pointed at you. If you've got a blaster and it's in your hand when we pull the lid off, we're gonna shoot you to shit.
Don't fire! I'm not armed!
Using the tip of his sheathed sword stick, Doc deftly flipped the plywood hatch out of the way. All weapons drew a bead on the diminutive figure cowering in the narrow, neck-deep pit. Camouflage do-rag askew, the man looked up into the muzzle of JB's 12-gauge and trembled. Slowly, he raised empty hands. There were angry skeeter bites on his face and bare arms, dozens and dozens of them.
Are you sick? Are you sick like the others?
No, I feel fine.
Get the fuck out of there, and be quick about it.
As the do-ragger scrambled from the pit, JB, Doc, and Christie moved well out of the way, giving Jack a clear background for a close-range kill shot with his .357 Magnum. Soft-looking, big brown eyes and 2 long lashes undercut the effect of a square-clefted, beard-stubbled chin. Mildred's immediate impression was Mama's boy. Tom scowled at the man.
I've never seen you here before. Who the hell are you?
I'm Daniel DiCipio. I'm a fire talker. A lot of people in the field came down sick. I was trying to help them.
You were helping them down that hole?
Islanders saw the pirates coming, and those what could still walk hightailed it up to the freighter. Because I wasn't of their blood, the bastards wouldn't let me in there, so I had to find my own place to hide.
How do you know they're pirates?
I don't know for certain that's who they are, but it sure seems like a safe guess.
What about the sickness that killed all those people down in the ville?
A crewman off a trader ship came down with it first, right after I arrived. Then just about everybody else came down with it. And then they started dying off, all in the space of 3 or 4 days.
I hasten to remind everyone that we could have easily avoided this unpleasantness.
Oh, shut up, Doc. Now is not the time.
Christie's right. What's done is done. What we need are some viable options to either dying from the fever or dying from gunshots.
We can still escape. There's still time. If we weigh anchor and continue south, we've got the wind behind us.
You mean run straight into the bastards and not away from them?
I can scoot Tempest along the edge of the mainland shore, right past those tugs, but far enough away so they can't cut us off. The pirate sailboats will be on the other side of the island by then. They won't see us leaving the bay, and when they do finally see us, we'll be on the horizon line. We'll have such a lead, they'll never catch us. My guess is they won't even try.
I don't like the looks of that.
JB nodded seaward. The 3 tugs had stopped their forward movement, and with idling engines, had taken up stationary positions roughly 1.5 miles offshore. They were spaced more than 700 yards apart in the lee of the island, on water that was flat and glassy.
Me either. We better get cracking.
Jack gestured with the python's muzzle to indicate the hands-up fire talker.
What about him?
Their bug-bit prisoner looked woeful and desperate. There was something practiced about his pathetic, pleading expression. When he batted his eyelashes, it made Mildred's skin crawl. Nobody else was buying it either.
He's still got his hidey hole. Let him jump back in it.
A bright flash and big puff of smoke from the forward deck of the middle tugboat caught Mildred's eye. Ryan and Christie saw it too. A fraction of an instant later, similar flashes and puffs of smoke appeared on the bows of the other 2 tugs.
Mortar rounds!
Mildred felt the concussions in the center of her chest, like the beats of an alien heart. 2 of the mortar hits fell 100 feet to either side of what looked like a distant machine gun emplacement, their blast rings overlapping. The 3rd landed a fraction of a second later in the middle of the roof, blowing out the sidewalls and collapsing the ceiling.
Shit! Come on!
Tom took off running, back the way they had come. The companions followed him, triple time. Mildred brought up the rear, keeping tabs on the injured JB, who, despite her concern, seemed to be moving along just fine. Behind her, The ships advanced on the now undefended shore. She and the others skidded, stumbled, and slewed down the loose sand of the dunes, scrambling to reach the beach and harbor. The mortar explosion started walking north, taking giant steps up the island's spine, toward the Vill. The first three explosions fell behind them. The second three leapfrogged the dunes and landed ahead and below, between them and the shantytown. The shells detonated on the flanks of the slope with brilliant flashes and plumes of flying sand and smoke. The concussions that rolled uphill felt like snap kicks to the gut. Even though Mildred ran with her stomach tensed, they almost knocked the breath out of her. Hot shrapnel sizzled and whined all around, snicking into the sandy hillside, and the acrid stink of burned Comp B filled the air. The companions were caught between the dunes at their rear and the high explosives in front. There was no cover ahead, but there was no going back. They couldn't stop running. More mortar shells screamed overhead, raining down on the Vill. The pirate gunners had it zeroed in. The shanty town came apart before their eyes, pounded by a concentrated barrage of HE. In the wake of blinding flashes, sheet metal roofs and plywood walls cartwheeled skyward, as did an ever-widening column of dust and smoke. The explosion started triggering the Claymore booby traps, which unleashed thousands of ball-bearing projectiles. The companions were running straight into a meat grinder. The route to the Tempest was cut off. They all skidded to a halt.
We'll never make it to the beach, Tom. Go right! Turn right!
Tom led them away from the ship, and their only hope of escape, away from the harbor and certain death. He raced along the lower slopes of the dunes, heading for the grounded freighter. It was the only way open. Then, the explosions in the Vill suddenly stopped. The pirate mortars went silent for a moment.
They stopped!
Mildred glanced over her shoulder and saw the fire talker was right on her heels. Chewing the stub of an unlit cigar, Barefoot Commander Guillermo Casacampo leaned out over the rail of the bridge deck of his flagship, called the Equay in Mayan, the Black Transformer in English. Casacampo's dreadlocks stood piled atop his head in a 10-inch-high, lopsided beehive. The stacked coils of felted hair were interlaced with gold bracelets and necklaces, and his long beard had been braided into stiff 6-inch pigtails, which were bound at the ends with close wraps of brightly colored thread. Ground in dirt and oil blackened his cheeks and forehead. The eyeliner that rimmed his eyes gave them a sunken, raccoon-like appearance. The commander of the Matachine fleet wore red long johns with a sewn-on chest pocket, and a parrot-green scarf knotted at the side of his very short, very thick neck. Looking down the starboard flank of the flat black-painted tug, Casacampo couldn't see the conscripts from Brownsville and Matamorosville that were pulling on the 30 massive oars. They were hidden from view beneath a crude corrugated steel awning that ran over the scuppers, fully two-thirds the length of the 100-foot boat. A similar structure shaded the port side of the ship. The awnings protected the bareheaded, bare-shouldered captives. The Matachine didn't give a damn about the comfort of their galley slaves. The slaves just lasted a little longer if they were shielded from the sun and rain. There were 15 oars on either side of the ship, and three rowers were assigned to each. A total of 90 prisoners working in chains, sleeping in chains, eating in chains, shitting in chains, all of them doomed. Two members of Casacampo's crew paced along the inside edge of the awning, closely monitoring the performance of the starboard propulsion unit. Because they were mere grunts and not line officers, their dreads weren't piled high. Instead, they hung like nests of flattened snakes to the middle of their wide backs. What gold the crewmen had glittered and flashed around the ankle tops of their heavy-soled boots, garlands of chain that had been taken from nameless, faceless victims as trophies of conquest. The crewmen's hands rested on the pommels of scabbarded machetes and on the butts of hip-holstered knockoff government Colts, 45 caliber weapons, relics from Mexico and Argentina. Braided leather quirts, short but effective motivational tools, were tucked under their belts. As the commander watched, the third oar from the stern suddenly seemed to lose its steam. Because it didn't move forward quickly enough, the paddle hooked on the shaft of the oar behind. Instead of immediately untangling and reestablishing the stroke rhythm, the two oars remained locked, which tipped the balance of thrust to the port side and caused the ship to veer off course to starboard. The problem was easily fixed. The commander hand-signaled the coxswain. When the drumming stopped, the slaves on both sides of the ship stopped pulling on their oars. Break time. The Matachin crewman quickly unchained an exhausted rower from the third starboard oar and dragged him out from under the awning. The slave didn't fight them. He was a spent force, his shoulders welted and bloodied from strokes of the lash, as weak as a kitten after so many non-stop days of effort. As the crew manhandled him aft toward the stern's low transom, he didn't even struggle. In the grasp of the crewman, the slave craned his neck around, looking up at the pirate leader. The slave's face was distorted by exhaustion and mortal fear. He knew what was coming.
Time to die.
The Matachin threw the slave belly down across the stern gunwale. While one pirate held him pinned from behind in a double arm lock, the other drew a machete. The top of the 16-inch blade ended in a rear-pointing hook, a crescent moon of razor-sharp steel. Originally designed to facilitate the cutting of sugar cane, the hook was even more efficient at unzipping human guts. Wielded by a powerful arm, the machete caught the sunlight as it flashed up, then fell in a blur. In a single strike of the blade's main edge, the pirate hacked open the back of the slave's neck, stopping short of completely severing his spine. The two Matachin fighters held him bent over the stern, while his red cha'ul, his soul stuff, poured over his face and head, and into the hungry sea till the body went limp and dead. His killers then grabbed him by the ankles and launched him headfirst into the water. The body floated away, spread-eagled and face down. The coxswain rolled aside his timekeeper's drum and raised the hatch in the stern deck. It opened onto the wide windowless hold where the replacement slaves were stowed until needed. Kneeling on either side of the hatch, the other two pirates bent over, reached down, and hauled up a blinking, dazed, and terrified slave by the armpits. The man was in his early 20s and had a wispy brown chin beard. Already stripped to the waist, his suntanned arms, face, and neck were a stark contrast to his fish-white belly. Before the crewmen chained him to the oar, they used their quirts on his back to make sure they had his attention. Although the replacement rower looked plenty strong and reasonably well-nourished, there was no telling how long he would last pulling an oar. Sometimes the strongest-looking ones died first, and the weaker-looking ones kept going and going. The coxswain glanced down into the hold. Pointing with his finger, he counted its occupants, one by one. He held up his hand to the bridge. Casacampo pulled a little leather-backed notebook from the chest pocket of his long johns. As he chewed the butt of his cigar, he corrected the tally with a pencil stub.
One down, five to go. This is good. We will run out of rowers just as we get to Padre Island. Any of the ones we have now that are no good, we'll kill them and replace them by survivors here. I am pleased.
Casacampo put the dog-eared notebook back in his long john pocket and waved at the coxswain to resume his drumming. When the beat started up, the oars dipped lively in time and in perfect unison. They were soon making excellent speed against the light wind. Close to 10 knots, Casacampo guessed. There was nothing like a summary execution to put the slaves in the mood for exercise. If, for some reason, the commander wasn't able to find replacement slaves en route, he did have a quantity of diesel to burn. But he watched his fuel gauges with as much care as his food stocks. Unlike the case of food, there was nowhere to get more diesel in the 600 miles of coastline the search and destroy expedition had covered. Accordingly, he saved his precious store of diesel for maneuvering during battle and for emergencies. The three tugs under his command had a total fuel load of just under 1,000 gallons. Enough to get them all the way home from Tierra de la Muerte, but if they returned to Veracruz on fumes, the fuel burned would deduct from the success of the expedition. Casacampo turned away from the stern and looked into the wind, toward the low island. His four pursuit craft were streaking away, hard to the southeast, under full sail. Soon they would be looping around the far end of the island, with the wind behind them. They would contain any attempts at escape by ship to the north.
What have we here?
Casacampo watched as a column of smoke coiled up from the other side of the ridge of dunes. Before the smoke could climb high in the sky, the prevailing wind bent it horizontal and sent it scudding toward him. Casacampo grinned around the gooey stump of his cigar. It was clear whose side the gods were on. Without haste, the commander ducked into an archway in the steel superstructure. Directly ahead was the riveted steel door leading to his quarters. He climbed the short, steep flight of metal steps on the right, up to the pilot house on the third story above the tug's main deck. Standing at the helm of the Equay, in front of the windshield and wraparound instrument panel, was his second-in-command, Captain Roberto Delore.
Commander.
The tall, leanly muscled, caramel-skinned man turned as Casacampo entered and gave him a respectful nod of greeting. Delore had a wandering left eye that never tracked with its opposite number. At times, when he was either very happy or very angry, Delore looked utterly and dangerously insane. Because he was a Matachin officer of lower rank, his pile of dreads was less spectacular. 3 coils of felted hair instead of Casacampo's 7, and it was laced with fewer golden trinkets. Delore had already donned his ribbed black chest, hip, and shin boot top armor. Back in the day, it had been made in Tampico from Kevlar and tempered steel trauma plate. The final touch of Delore's battle dress, a seam-split garment stained with blood, semen, and tears, lay draped over the back of the navigator's armchair. Into every fight, the captain wore the dead woman's shift. He wore it pulled over his chest armor. It was so short on his body that it looked like a long shirt. To his opponents in combat, its feminine cut and faded floral print and its awful stains were animalistic obscenity. To the pirate captain, the ruined dress was yet another badge of status, symbolic of having seized and taken the sustaining and nourishing spiritual force, the eats of a defenseless victim. In the low pilot house ceiling, in the niches and crannies between the clusters of exposed power conduit and electronic cables, were a wide assortment of Central American fetishes. There were amulets made of feathers and human small bones stripped of flesh and sinew and bleached dead white. There were brightly beaded pouches of copal incense, and dangling by their ornate little headdresses, flesh-colored molded plastic statuettes of the Lords of Death, fanged, snarling, squatting like pink toads over the hieroglyph for Vol, the secret gate of Xibalba, the place of awe. In their left hands, the lords brandished ceremonial stone cleavers, which dripped hand-painted enamel blood down their forearms. In their right hands, they held severed human heads by the hair. The ragged neck stumps were also hand-painted red. The doll collection represented Atapul I through Atapul X. The statuettes were virtually identical, except for the raised Roman numerals on their gold-plated breastplates that identified them individually. The Mayan legend of the Lords of Death was older than recorded time. From their kingdom in the other world of Xibalba, rumored to exist somewhere beneath the earth, they held dominion over human sickness, starvation, fear, destitution, pain, and ultimately death. The other residents of the other world, spirits, ghosts of ancestors, goblins, were compelled to rise up and carry out the will of these dark gods on the surface. According to the ancient myth, the hero twins, Hunuhapu and Xpalanque, succeeded in tricking and killing all 12 of the Lords of Death, which left their avatars of sickness and disease stranded and without direction in the mortal plane. In the Mayan legends, resurrection was not unheard of. Indeed, the promise of same was how the hero twins fooled and destroyed the Lords of Death. After watching the twins restore life to a dead dog, a person, and themselves with their magic dance, the lords asked the twins to kill them too, then bring them back. The twins slaughtered the lords all right, but they left them dead. For 5,000 years, the Lords of Xibalba stayed that way, until the Armageddon of El Norte resurrected them. Through the pilot house's front windshield, Padre Island loomed large. Casacampo referred to the crude hand-drawn map that lay atop the control console. A captured resident of Brownsville had been convinced, under torture, to set down the major features of the island, including the hardened gun emplacements and the position of the harbor and the ville, neither of which could be seen from a southwesterly approach. Based on the map, the smoke had to be coming from the Ville. It gave his Marachin gunners something to aim at. The commander picked up a laser rangefinder and took aim at the nearest point of land. Reading the LED display, he glanced at Delore.
Another 300 yards and we'll be well within range.
The commander checked the row of gauges that measured the status of the ship's electric power, which came from solar panels on the pilot house roof when the engines were not in use. The batteries were fully charged. He took the cigar out of the corner of his mouth, raised the microphone to his lips, and pressed the transmit button on the ship-to-ship radio.
Attention! Attention! Shimalbe and Whitebone Snake, this is Ekwe. Take positions 1,200 meters from target one. Prepare your mortars. Shimalbe and Whitebone Snake, start your engines. Advance your attack positions at once. Await my command to begin firing.
Delore cranked up the Ekwe's powerful twin diesels. Turning the switch on the radio from ship to ship to loudhailer, the commander addressed his crew through speakers mounted fore and aft.
Ship oars, pull in! Ship oars, pull in! Break out the mortars and prepare for firing!
Through the pilot house's rear bank of windows, past the davited inflatable rafts they used as landing craft, the commander had a clear view of the aft deck. While four of his crew saw to the stowing of the oars, four others unshackled eight slaves and set them to work on the artillery. They broke out two XM-252 mortars from the lockers behind the superstructure. It took two slaves to carry each set of separated launch tube mount and aluminum base plate, and another four to carry the metal crates of stacked HEM-374A3 ammunition. Casacampa walked around the wheelhouse windows, following as a pair of slaves headed for the bow with their disassembled mortar. There, they fitted the base into one of the steel keyhole fittings inset in the foredeck. Then the mount was secured on the base and the launch tube to the mount. A second mortar was positioned amidships on the tug's port side. As the crates of 81mm HE shells were laid close to hand, Delore eased back on the throttle and took the engines out of forward gear.
That's 1,200 meters, Commander.
Hold us steady.
The water was as flat as a pancake, not even a slight rise and fall. The breeze was a constant 6 knots. Perfect conditions.
Lorenzo, light up your shot!
Sitting on the MG post through the mortar's M53 elbow telescope, the Marachin gunner took his distance measurement, gauged the speed of the headwind, then quickly adjusted the angle of the launch tube to drop a shell on the target. When he was satisfied, he gave the pilot house a wave. Casacampo flicked the radio back to ship to ship.
Shimalbe, Whiteborn Snake, are you ready?
Shimalbe here. Ready, Commander.
Whiteborn Snake here. Aye, sir.
Fire away!
Casacampo leaned forward and gave his waiting crewman the hand signal to drop one on the target. The bow gunner slid the shell down the pipe, aluminum fins first, ducking to the side and covering his ears. The tugs a half mile on either side of them fired their mortars as well. All three rounds flew in high, looping arcs toward the beach. The commander watched through binocs as the targets in the village were bracketed, then vanished in a flare of orange and black. Down in the Ekwe's bow, the gunner Lorenzo was thumping his chest, grinning from ear to ear, and nodding like he was the man. Casacampo grinned, then turned back to Delore as he picked up the radio.
All three tugs, pull in closer, 500 meters.
Casacampo returned to the windows overlooking the stern. Some of his Marachin were sitting on the gunwales, sharpening their machetes' gut hooks with files and whetstoning the long edges. Others were in the process of putting on their body armor or setting out the weapons and ammunition for the coming assault. As the other two tugs approached the second firing positions, their complements of Marachin Marines were doing the same thing. The Lord's invisible weapons were their duendes, their enanos, dwarves and goblins who took the terrible sickness with them wherever they went. A certain percentage of those stricken by the Shibalban disease were only mildly impaired. A smaller percentage were completely unaffected. They were the ones harvested to make up the galley crews. The Lords had used this dominion over human suffering and fear to great effect over the past 100 years, building an empire of city-states along the Atlantic coast of Central America. In terms of Enanos, the current expedition had been costly. Between the battles for Matamorosville and Brownsville, 5 of the 6 he had brought along on the voyage had been lost. It was only a temporary setback, though. The Lords of Death could always make more. Looking down on his fighters, the commander knew that he felt exactly what they felt. Exhilaration. He sensed what they sensed. The smell of blood. The Matachin were demons in the service of greater demons. In return for their allegiance, the Lords of Death promised everlasting pillage in life. In death, everlasting delight. Their savage spirits would reside among the towering pyramids and vast acropolises of Xibalba.
500 meters.
Time to close the trap. Bring us broadside to the wheel. Fire at will.
There wasn't much to see as the shells rained down on the vill. The target was hidden behind the high dunes. As the erratic booms of the barrage rolled over the water, black smoke billowed over the crest of the ridge. Casacampo turned to his own preparations for combat. From a locker in a corner of the pilot house, he took out his personal firearm. The Brazilian-made Lapa had an M16-style carrying handle that housed its flip-type rear sight. The front sight was an elevated protected post. Very stubby from pistol grip to muzzle, it looked like a handgun with a fixed plastic shoulder stock. The Lapa was chambered for 9mm parabellum rounds and held 32 bullets in its curved mag. The commander checked the clip to make sure it was topped off, then reinserted it into the weapon and collected 6 more full mags from the locker. At the bottom of the cabinet was his machete, pearl-handled and scabbarded in black ballistic nylon. He unsheathed the gleaming blade, which was engraved on both sides with the hieroglyph of the Black Transformer, the symbolic gate of Xibalba. At the tip was a cruel steel horn, razor-sharp on its inside edge, the Matachin's signature death hook. Setting the machete aside, Casacampo took out his custom-fitted black chest and back plates and black leg and shin guards. After stepping into and lacing up his steel-toed boots, he began buckling on the ribbed body armor, all of which had been blessed by the Lords of Death. He was dressing for a very short, very one-sided war. Even though the 3 mortar shells had stopped falling, Ryan could still feel the after effects of the all-too-close explosions. The soles of his feet tingled down to the tips of his toes, and there was a slight numbness to the side of his face. He ran on with grim determination, knowing there was nothing ahead for him and the companions, but a bit more breathing room. Maybe some time to think. Time to come up with another escape plan. If they made it to the freighter before the barrage resumed. He had seen the north end of the island on the way down, and he knew it didn't offer an obvious way out of their predicament. The waters were a jigsaw puzzle of shallow, sandy reefs. There was no protected moorage, so there were no boats tied up offshore. There weren't any boats beached there, either. The grounded freighter above them had all the makings of a death ship. Based on what he'd seen in the vill, he figured it was likely filled with sick people and corpses. Once the companions ventured below decks, there was a better-than-even chance that they would never come out. The ship was like a box canyon, only man-made and with a steel lid. But they didn't have a choice. Even if they could have reached the channel separating the island from the mainland, it was far too wide to try to swim. With the tempest cut off, the freighter was the only place to go. The moment the shells started pounding the vill, Ryan guessed what the pirates were up to. Their strategy was designed to drive everyone who could walk or run out of the shanty town, up the hill, and into the grounded ship. Otherwise, they would have shelled the shit out of it, too. Running behind Harmonica Tom, Ryan and the others started up the flank of the immense dune on which the vessel sat. Above them, an even steeper ramp, about 10 feet wide and sculpted of hard-packed sand, led all the way to the top deck and the gate and the freighter's rail amidships. If Tom knew where he was going, he also knew the immediate danger they faced. As soon as they hit the base of the compacted ramp, he started waving his arms.
It's me! Don't shoot! It's me!
As Ryan started up the ramp, he saw the reason for Tom's concern. Rows of irregular vertical slits had been hacked or blowtorched into the freighter's steel hull plates. They were maybe 5 inches wide and 2 feet high. Gun ports. From all the bullet impact dimples and spalled paint around them, this wasn't the first time Padre Island had come under attack. Ryan couldn't see a rifle muzzle behind every slit, and most of the muzzles he did see weren't tracking them as they climbed. They were stationary. That all the guns weren't manned didn't matter. More than enough moved to do the job. Once an enemy boarding party started up the ramp, there was no escape. Nowhere to jump, nowhere to hide. The entire length of the ramp was a kill zone. Tom cleared the gate at the top of the ramp. Ryan stepped onto the ship beside the skipper. Looking back, he watched as the others rushed through the gate, one by one. Only after Mildred reached the deck did he realize that they picked up some unwanted baggage. He glared at the fire talker.
I thought I told you to jump back down that red-blasted hole.
What the hell is this?
The Tagalong was out of breath, or pretended to be, and didn't respond. He shuffled to the far side of Doc, as far away from Ryan as he could get, and still remained under the companion's protection. Christy whirled around, looking up and down the vast 250-yard-long top deck.
Where is everybody?
There was no movement anywhere, but the line of sight was blocked by rows of rusting cargo containers, stacked three high in places. Crude ladders made of lashed-together iron pipe leaned against the open doors of some of the topmost boxes. As the vessel's cargo booms had been torn away, there was no way to lower any of the massive containers to the deck to get at the contents. The islanders had to climb up to them using the ladders and carry or rope lower the goods. Ryan looked down a long, canyon-like aisle between the stacks to the stern. Looming over everything, still flying the tattered Lone Star flag, was the bridge tower. It had looked more or less intact from the water. Up close, it was an absolute ruin. The six-story structure was laced with a million rust holes. Ryan could see light all the way through it, front to back. Every window frame was empty of glass. It had taken a terrible beating on Nuke Day, and the beating had continued for a century after. Tom turned to face him.
We need to do a quick wreck of the situation.
He waved the others after him as he headed for the bow, which rested on the peak of the dune and stuck up higher than the stern. Ryan kicked through ankle-deep piles of rubbish, discarded packaging from the contents of the containers, and dunnage from the holds. Plastic, cardboard, pieces of broken wooden pallets, foam pellets. The trash collected in drifts along the scuppers and around bases of the lowermost containers. Some of the bottom container doors were open. There were no bodies evident, outside or inside the boxes. From the ship's bow, they looked almost straight down on the bill. Black smoke poured off the flattened ruins. Low fire still burned from the mortar rounds that had been dropped on it. Between those and the claymores, there wasn't much left. Tom scowled in the opposite direction. Ryan turned to see sailboats scooting northeast, past the island on the gulf side.
The bastards are heading for Aransas Pass. They're gonna circle around the line of reefs and come down the waterway to the harbor, same way we did.
That's bad?
Good and bad, Mildred. Good, because it gives us more time to reach the Tempest. They gotta beat against the wind to make the pass. Bad, because they're gonna have the wind at their backs once they 180 and bear down on us. If we don't have a big head start, we're in trouble.
JB pointed to where, much closer in, the trio of tugs moved north under engine power, to about a half mile off the beach, directly opposite the stranded freighter.
They're tightening the noose, damn it.
Ryan, can we fight them off? Do we have a chance?
Maybe, Christy. Depends on what they do next.
If these brigands intend to take whatever's in all these containers as spoils of war, they're unlikely to turn their mortars on the ship.
If they don't want what the islanders have, this is going to be a piss-poor place to mount a defense.
We need to find out where the other islanders are, and how many are in shape to help us fight.
This way, toward the stern.
Everyone keep your blasters holstered. Let's not give these island folks the wrong idea.
Or an excuse.
They proceeded down the deck alongside the stacks of rusting containers. The narrow aisles, with towering stacks on either side, were made to order for a crossfire ambush from above. But no ambush materialized. Tom stopped them, opposite a bollard on the right. The massive steel stump had been originally used to secure the eye of the waist-breast mooring line after it passed through a large opening in the port rail. Now the bollard backstopped a machine gun position. Its bipod legs, heavily sandbagged in place, a well-worn M60 overlooked and controlled the southern approach to the island. Or it would have, if anybody was home. Connected to an ammo satchel by a belt of 7.62mm cartridges, the weapon had been abandoned. Doc waved a hand for attention.
Look over there.
He pointed 50 feet aft and to the left, where on the ground the sole of a white basketball shoe peeked around the corner of a deck-level container. They moved quickly but cautiously in that direction. The islander wearing the shoe was belly down and newly dead. Perhaps he had been the machine gunner. There was no way of telling. His face, neck, and exposed arms bore the same red marks they had seen in the vill. and there was dark, congealed blood around his nose and mouth. Mildred shook her head.
Another victim of the virus.
Live one!
Jack reached for his holstered python, but stopped just short of the butt. Ryan reached Jack's side to confront a blonde boy of no more than 14 who had popped out from a narrow gap between the containers. He wore a gaudy short-sleeved shirt and shorts and high-topped basketball shoes like the dead gunner. Only his looked three sizes too large. His hair had been shaved to stubble, and there were deep circles under his blue eyes. He didn't look sick, just exhausted. He was haggard but hard-focused, and he seemed entirely comfortable holding the full-stock AKM in his hands. Apparently, a 14-year-old was the only one defending the freighter's deck. He leveled the assault rifle to fire from the waist.
Who the fuck are you?
Ryan could see the selector switch was set on full auto. At the present range, there was no way the kid could miss.
We're not with the bastards who shelled your ville, so you need to put down the weapon.
The boy showed no sign of doing that. Just the opposite. His mouth tightened into a narrow seam, and his fingertip curled around the trigger as he braced the metal-shod butt hard against his right hip. The teenager looked from person to person, first the eyes, then the hands, clearly noting the fact that although their weapons were not drawn, they were within easy reach. The expression on his face stayed defiant and murderous.
I know I can't cheer you all, but I can mess up most of you before you get me.
We're not the enemy.
The AKM's muzzle swung to the left, locking on Ryan's midsection.
Get down on your knees, Eyepatch.
That's not gonna happen. You need to take a deep breath and settle down.
Fuck your advice, mister.
We've all got the same problem. Look over there.
Ryan nodded toward the three tugs, which had stopped 500 yards off the beach and were holding position, parallel to the freighter's deck.
Mattachine!
Who?
Mattachine! Murdering pirate scum that come up the coast from Mex. We heard they already burned Matamorisville and Brownsville to the ground. If you don't believe me, ask him.
The haggard teen gestured with the AKM, pointing out the tagalong who was still keeping well back of the rest, pretending to be Doc's shadow.
He's the one who told us about him.
Funny, he didn't mention it to us.
Maybe it slipped his mind. Is that what happened?
Daniel DeCipio paled. He glanced around rapidly, trying to find a way out of this conversation.
Not very talkative for a fire talker, is he?
Not now, maybe. But you should have heard him when he first got here, before everybody took sick. He was on and on about all this triple-stoop shit from Mars and how it was part of the Mex Pirates' plan to take over the hellscape. There was more bullshit about other people that he said came from the moon. Some of them were these giant mutant vegetables that could talk, drink whiskey, and shoot blasters. Nobody with Norm brains could make sense of his Martian moon crapperoo. The only ones on the island who paid him any mind were the droolies. They followed him like baby ducks everywhere he went, even to the shitter. Everyone Norm wanted to shut him up permanently, either by stringing him up by the neck from the radar mast or by making him swim buck naked for the mainland through a chum slick.
The fire talker's lip quivered as he stared around at the companions.
Why do they hate me? All I am is an entertainer, a storyteller.
If the ratty man thought he would win sympathy, he was quite wrong. Every face turned toward him, showing varying degrees of disgust. Tom shook his head and turned back to the boy.
Hey, don't I know you? Sure I do. You're one of Nelson Reed's kids.
I'm Garwood Reed. Pa's dead. So's Ma. So's most everyone. Or else they're so damn sick they can't hold a blaster.
We're all in for it, Garwood. You need our blasters to help defend the ship. We've got to pull together. You need to take us to the others. There's no time to waste.
That shit for brains fire talker doesn't even have a blaster. Why does he have to come with us? Why can't he just stay out here on deck?
I can help the sick ones.
Nose and butt whack. That's all he's good for.
Enough. We don't have time for this. Move it, kid.
Garwood showed up and sulkily complied with the order. He slung his AKM and began a quick trot for the bridge tower. The companions followed Garwood through a doorway at the base of the superstructure and onto the tower's ground floor. Ryan could see through the huge rusted-out gaps in the ceiling to the story above. The teenager made a beeline for a metal staircase leading to the ship's lower levels. On the landing wall was a row of burning torches and crude stanchions. Garwood snatched one of them and started down the steps. The flame threw a weak light down the pitch-dark stairwell. Ryan and Doc each grabbed torches and held them high, lighting the way for the others as they descended single file. As they passed the second landing, Ryan smelled the sickness wafting up from below. Vomit sweet and triple foul. When they reached the upper tween deck, Garwood exited the staircase and led them onto an all-metal corridor that extended into the dim distance, apparently the full length of the ship. The boy slipped his torch into an empty wall stanchion. Ryan and Doc followed suit. Torches weren't necessary. Sunlight streamed through the blaster ports, cutting narrow vertical wedges through the gloom. Most of the weapons Ryan had seen coming up the ramp were propped up on crates and unmanned. They had been positioned to look like there was an army lying in wait. The Islanders had plenty of weapons, all right, but they were big-time short on gunners. Every fifth or sixth assault rifle had an actual person behind it. A couple were kids 4 or 5 years younger than the companion's guide, and 30 pounds lighter. Ryan found it hard to believe that the first jolt of recoil wouldn't put them square on their skinny little butts. There were a total of 15 adults on the entire firing line. Tom stared in disbelief.
Garwood? This can't be everybody.
Garwood unlatched a bulkhead door into a main hold. As the door swung back, it was clear that the hold was where all the moaning was coming from, and the smell. It was lightless, except for torches flickering in stanchions along the walls, airless and stiflingly hot. The metal walls steadily dripped rivulets of condensation, which had pooled on the metal deck. Cargo containers were stacked 3 high inside the hold. They created canyons of darkness where no light penetrated. The upper tween deck hold was part hospital and part morgue, but mostly morgue. Islander bodies lay uncovered among the rubbish drifts of splintered wood, cardboard, and burlap sacking. At a glance, it was impossible to tell how many people were still alive. A dozen or so were on their feet, though, and moving here and there around the hold, trying to help the stricken. The companions remained grouped near the entryway. With the smoke from the torches, the weak, erratic light they threw, the looming walls of the stacked containers, the incessant moaning, and the smell of sickness and decay, it was like some lower pit of hell. Tom cupped his hands to his mouth.
Who's in charge?
A jut-jawed woman straightened from tending one of the moaners.
Who the fuck's asking?
Wide across the hips, she had hugely fat and doughy upper arms. The pockets of the bird hunting vest that she'd somehow managed to squeeze into bulged to bursting with high brass shotgun rounds. Sweat plastered her thin brown hair to her skull in stringy plaits. Slung on a canvas strap over her right shoulder was a sawed-off 12-gauge pump shotgun.
It's me, Tom Wolfe. Is that you, Brenda?
Recognizing him, the woman looked surprised. Then she smiled.
Damn it to hell. Captain Tom, you sure went and picked yourself a shitty time to pay a visit.
Spilt milk, Brenda. I'm here, and that's the truth.
You seen what those Mex pirates done to our vill?
You don't have a vill anymore, Brenda. And those same bastards are going to be climbing up our butts shortly. I don't get the feeling they're in a merciful mood today. It's going to come down to chill or be chilled. How many of yours are well enough to stand and fight?
Maybe 25 total. Some of the girls are too little to hold a rifle, let alone shoot one. But what we've got to do first is blow up the access ramp. Make him use ropes and grappling hooks to reach the top deck. That can't wait. Charges are already set. Someone has to go out and light the fuse.
The sick man she was tending to suddenly lurched up into a sitting position.
I'm okay. I can do it, I can do it. I'll blow up the ramp.
It was obvious that he was not okay. He sprayed blood mist out of his mouth all down his shirt front. A fresh coat. It was clear he was dying.
Jimbo, right now you couldn't blow up dog shit.
Brenda took gentle hold of his shoulders and pushed him back down. She walked over to Tom and Garwood.
Someone's got to blow that ramp.
Send the fire talker.
Daniel's eyes widened, and he backed up a few feet.
I don't know anything about explosives. I'm a storyteller, a fabulator.
All you gotta do is light the fucking fuse.
Nuke in hell. You can't trust someone like him to do it right, or at all.
Even a drooly could light a fucking fuse.
Yeah, even a drooly. Make him do it. Make him go out there and do it.
Ryan glanced back through the open door to see Jack move to one of the unmanned gun ports and press his face against the opening, looking across the water at the parked tugs. Only a couple of seconds passed before Jack spun away from the gunport.
Incoming! Incoming!
Before anyone could react, mortar rounds screamed down on the ship, detonating one after another on the main deck above them. A non-stop roar of explosions and tremendous concussion waves. Everything began to shake and roll. Ryan staggered from one side of the corridor to the other. He swung the Styra around on its shoulder strap, trying to protect its scope against his chest. He hit the exterior wall with his back, and then was thrown forward. He crashed to his knees. Shockwaves flexed and rippled the metal floor beneath him, and overlapping concussions pounded inside his skull. Another volley of shells blasted the main deck, bow to stern. Dust and pulverized rust cascaded from the ceiling, obscuring the hallway in a boiling cloud. It even choked out most of the light pouring in through the gun ports. Ryan turned his face to the inner wall and raised a forearm across his brow to protect his one good eye from the debris fall. The pressure was like a giant boot stomping him head to toe. The world kept going white inside his head, wall to wall white, then black, as his consciousness winked in and out. Doc had guessed right. The pirates didn't give a damn about the cargo. They were blowing the islanders' booty all to hell, blasting the stacked containers apart, sending the topmost ones thundering down onto the deck. And it sounded like some of the huge boxes were sliding over the side. The impact jolted the floor under his knees, and a column of light suddenly speared through the roiling dust, through the open door of the makeshift sickbay. The top deck was ripped open, uncapping the hold's roof. Through the cloud of dust, Ryan saw the able-bodied islanders frantically lurching, stumbling, and spilling out of the bulkhead doorway as they tried to escape falling metal. Some of them made it out, but not in one piece. The tugboat mortars dropped more rounds right down the hole they had just blown through the top deck, dropped them into the middle of the upper tween deck hold. A tight cluster of explosions from behind blew the runners out of their boots, out of the doorway, sending their bodies and severed parts of same slamming into the inside of the hull. A tremendous rush of searing hot explosive wind momentarily blasted away the dust, and Ryan got a glimpse of Brenda, who was on the outer side of the ajar hold door, pulling herself up to her feet by the handle. As another shell detonated, sending shrapnel flying out the doorway and into the hull, she used the back of the door as a shield. Throwing her considerable weight against it, she slammed it shut. But before she could drop the latch or jump away, multiple shells exploded inside the hold. The door blew back, and the corridor steel walls bulged, popping out rows of rivets. Brenda hit the floor hard and stayed down. The floor under Ryan undulated like it was made of liquid. There was nothing to hold on to. There was no escape from what was coming. Ryan was certain that the next volley would take out the buckled wall, the hallway, and everything in between. But when more shells rained down on the freighter, the explosions didn't blow out the corridor walls. Instead, they bowed up the floor, which suddenly became too hot to touch. Ryan realized as he scrambled to get his boot soles under him that the muffled blasts had come from the deck below. A tightly grouped barrage had opened a hole in the upper tween deck, allowing HE to fall even deeper into the ship. Pirate gunners were coring it like an apple. Then the shell stopped falling, and everything went deadly quiet. The floor stopped undulating. It was finally over. Ryan used the buttstock of the Styre as a crutch. He pushed himself to his feet, then staggered around a heap of broken, unmoving bodies to the nearest gunport. Through the churning dust and smoke, over the barrel of an AKM, he could see one of the tugs had already swung a pair of rafts into the water, and the heavily armed landing parties were rowing for the beach. The other two tugs had launched their rafts, and were loading them with men and gear on the far sides of their pilot houses. Up and down the hallway, the survivors of the mortar attack were stirring.
Get to the blasters! Get to the blasters!
Ryan looked back outside. 20 hostile targets were approaching the shore, with about twice that many about to debark the other tugs. It was a situation that called for firepower, not finesse. He carefully set the bolt-action Steyr on the floor. Before he checked the AKM's mag, he brushed the dust and grit off the top of the receiver and ejection port. The clip was full, and there were six more on the deck at his feet. He picked up a couple, checked the round counters, and stuck them into the back of his belt. Before he reinserted the rifle's mag, he looked down the bore to make sure it was clear. As he charged the actuator handle, chambering the magazine's first bullet, there was movement all along the firing line. The survivors were stepping up to the guns. Because of the smoke, he couldn't see very far down the corridor, but he could see Christy and Doc on his left, hunched over their own assault rifles. They looked unhurt.
Everybody! This is Ryan! Check in! Check in! Let's hear you!
Mildred!
Jack!
Christy!
AB!
Tom, here!
Each affirmative sent a surge of relief coursing through Ryan. There was no way of telling how many other people had lived through the barrage. However many it was going to have to do. Ryan knew he couldn't count on any of them having fired an automatic rifle before, let alone be able to hit moving targets at long range.
Don't shoot until they come ashore! Wait until they're on the ramp! Then they won't be able to use the mortars without hitting their own troops! We've got to sit tight and let them come to us! Wait until they're so close we can't miss! Check your actions and barrels, make sure there's nothing stuck in them. Make sure you've got extra mags close to hand.
Ryan used the hem of his t-shirt to wipe his eye, which was tearing profusely, trying to rid itself of dust. When his vision cleared, he looked out the gunport again. The two rafts were moving at a rapid clip, four sets of oars dipping in unison, rowers really putting their backs into the strokes. The pirates knew until they reached the shore that they were dangerously exposed. 400 yards, 300 yards.
Everyone hold your fire! Don't shoot yet! Let all the pirates land! Let them get close!
200 yards. The tension in the islanders was so thick, Ryan thought he'd choke on it. The air reeked of their rage and fear, and exhausted desperation. 100 yards. Off to Ryan's right, out of sight in the gloom, an AKM opened fire. And once that happened, there was no stopping the rest of them.
Aw, shit!
There was only one thing left for him to do. Join the turkey shoot. He snugged into the AKM's buttstock and dropped the fire selector to full auto. He looked down the iron sights.
Aim low!
No one had heard him, or if they had, they didn't understand that he was warning them to compensate for their elevation and down angle. The others were shooting way high. A mini hailstorm was hitting the water between the rafts and the tugboat that had launched them. At least six of the AKs would be on target, his and the companion's. Ryan dropped the sight post a good 5 inches below the bow of the first raft and cut loose a short burst. The bullet splashed 60 feet in front of the bow. He raised the sights, cutting the low hold in two, and pinned the trigger. He let the muzzle climb, walking the stream of slugs right up the middle of the boat. The vibration of the autofire and the distance to target made it hard to see exact hits. The hailstorm had definitely found the pirates. As Ryan stripped out the empty mag and reached behind his back for a fresh one, the combined firepower of 20 or so AKMs finally locked on the invaders, more or less. The water around the two craft was whipped to a froth by hundreds of 7.62mm rounds. The pirates in the rafts didn't attempt to return fire. Those that hadn't already abandoned ship were too busy dying. Under the swell of bullets, both boats' pontoons took multiple hits. They burst and immediately started to deflate. Without flotation, there was nothing to keep the plywood floors from sinking beneath the weight of the dozen or so bodies they each supported. And sink is what they did, leaving some of the corpses drifting on the blood-slicked surface. Even though the enemy was face down and out of the fight, the islanders continued to hammer their backs with gunfire. Other gunners along the firing line tracked the pirates who jumped ship and were trying to swim for the beach. The accuracy required was too far and too fine. The pirates dived under the water to avoid being hit.
Hold your fire!
Again, no one was listening to Ryan. Buoyed up by their success, the islanders started strafing all three tugs, fanning at them with lead. They were burning up ammo like there was no tomorrow. Some of the slugs were landing on the boats, though. They had to be, based on sheer volume and concentration. The three tugs had low metal awnings along the sides of their top decks. Because of the down angle, Ryan's view was completely blocked. He couldn't see if anything of importance was being hit. The second fusillade was pointless, except in celebration of a temporary victory. The other four rafts were protected by the ship's hulls. All the pirates had to do was move to the far side of the wheelhouse to avoid the auto fire. As simple as that. After another minute or so of melee, the islanders stopped shooting.
We did it!
Dine, feed the sharks, you pirate bastards!
Turning back the pirates had been a piece of cake. It was way too easy, as far as Ryan was concerned. He knew something triple bad was coming. Before he could snatch up his rifle and gather his companions, it was on top of them. The world went white again, white and blistering hot, and the outside wall seemed to jump into Ryan's face. He bounced off the AKM and the gunport, bounced backward onto his side on the deck, facing the stern. Blinding orange strobe light flashed the length of the corridor, and the exterior wall imploded, sending steel plates and shrapnel flying down the hall, ricocheting off and gouging through the opposite wall. If people were screaming as they were hit, their cries were lost in the roar of the detonations. The floor and the wall slammed into Ryan. He was rattled like a marble in a jar as waves of skin-melting heat washed over him. He tried to crawl to where he'd last seen Christy, but he couldn't make headway, and all he could see through the smoke and dust and screaming shrapnel were the brilliant flashes of igniting HE. The pirate mortars were firing at low angles into the side of the ship, blowing apart sections of the hull and the gunners behind it. A heavy, warm body crashed into Ryan from behind, landing across his legs. He turned to push it off. In a flash of HE light, he saw the Islander man reach up to grab the end of a jagged spike of steel that protruded from the side of his neck.
No, don't. Don't pull it out.
The shockwave slammed them, and then everything went black again. 2 seconds later, another explosion lit the hallway, and Ryan saw that it was already too late. The Islander had yanked the dagger of steel from his throat. Bright arterial blood was jetting out of his neck. He tried to staunch the unstoppable flow with his fingers. Ryan felt the man's weight fall back across his legs. As he kicked himself free, the explosion stomped away from him, toward the stern. It was as though the pirate mortars were trying to cut the ship in two, lengthwise. Realizing that he had a window of opportunity, Ryan forced his arms and legs into motion. Ignoring the sharp debris that covered the floor, he started crawling as fast as he could toward the last place he had seen Christy. The side of the ship opened up not 15 feet away. It was pure, instantaneous, incomprehensible force. Orange light, intense heat. A blast wave lifted him sideways and slammed him headfirst into the interior wall. Everything went black. And this time, it stayed black.